Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, Braden and I are going to discuss one of the more epic escapades in South Dakota's political and financial and economic history. It is the absconding of the state treasurer with all of the state's funds. Braden, thanks for helping me out today.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, who is this guy? What's his name?
There's even kind of some discrepancy in his name. Most people know him by William W. Taylor, but sometimes it's been listed as Walter William, William Walter. It just kind of depends, but we're going to go with William Walter Taylor.
Okay.
Yeah, William W. Taylor.
That's the name that is known in public at the time. Yeah, William W. Taylor, elected to be treasurer of South Dakota.
Excuse me. No, it's people used Walter William Taylor. Geez, I'm even getting mixed up now.
Well, yeah, you see it both ways, and so it's hard to keep up. And in many cases, they just call him W.W. Taylor. Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll stick with that to be accurate. But W.W. Taylor is elected to be the treasurer of South Dakota and reelected to be the treasurer of South Dakota.
1892.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 1892, and then reelected in 1894. And in that capacity, he is responsible for all the state's funds, just as the treasurer is today. So cash and gold and other assets that the state might own and currency are given over to his care, and he places them in commercial banks around the state. Under what laws does he do this, Braden? What kind of fiscal oversight is in place for Mr. Taylor?
Not a lot.
Yes.
No, Mr. Taylor, he does put the money in several banks throughout the state,
yep.
But also in his own bank. He owns the Redfield Bank, which is First National Bank, general manager of the Northwestern Mortgage Trust Company, also the president of the Gettysburg State Bank. So he has all of these, and all of them get state funds.
And this was normal the way they do that, but there's certainly in 1893, there's a massive economic collapse around the country, and people who are investing in real estate and development projects in mines throughout the West are now often, and in banks and in public utilities and projects and so forth, often now see that their funds are being called by their banks. And so there's a lot of depreciation of accounts and a lot of missing accounts and a lot of runs on the banks. And it seems clear that Taylor's management of these funds, which is lightly monitored by anybody, is put to the limit in his ability to keep up with things, or when he's required to turn over all of the accounts to the new incoming treasurer, that's when he has to fess up. And that's when the new governor, who had just said publicly about him, incoming elected governor Charles Sheldon, praised the departing treasurer with the following words: "Mr. W.W. Taylor, our efficient and faithful outgoing treasurer, is entitled to the thanks of the people for the zeal and energy which he has at all times displayed in the management of his office. And as a matter of pride to him, as to the state officers with whom he has been associated these past 2 years, that he leaves the public service carrying with him the unbounded respect of those who have known his business methods and his desire to preserve the credit of his state. The next day, after the governor found out a few details about things, the governor sent a written message to the legislature asking that his words be stricken from the official journal. They didn't want that lasting in history. And unfortunately, for Governor Sheldon, those words do last because they might have been stricken from the record, but they made it into other documents. And so he found out, as did a few other people, that Taylor has left the country.
Because Taylor just refuses to show up in Pierre to turn over the monies. Not many people knew about him fleeing, even his own employees at the First National Bank in Redfield.
Right. Back in Redfield, they get a visitor from state government asking to withdraw the state's funds in that bank, and they verify, yes, they're here. And then as they're sorting through the mail, they find Taylor's letter to them. And what does that letter say?
The state official is Alex Johnson. He jumps on a train early in the morning and heads to Redfield, gets there before the bank is open, is waiting there at 8:45. He heads in with Frank Humphrey, who's the teller of the bank. He asks what the balance is. Humphrey gets the ledger and he says $29,366.36. And Johnson asks to withdraw it all. This gets them talking and kind of confused. Meanwhile, the vice president, Charlie Vinton, comes in and has a stack of letters. They're going through the letters when one of them, Humphrey, exclaims, "For God's sake, look at this." And then Vinton reads aloud a letter from Taylor who said in brief, "The men who owe me have failed, and I have to leave the country for until a settlement is made. Further, Frank, on account of your good management, the First National Bank is not involved in any way by me and is 100% sound." Well, the bank officials quickly close the bank.
Yes, this is high crimes and a lot of misdemeanors, I think is what's going on here. And they are, they've got a lot of explaining to do. And so back in Pierre, the governor and the attorney general kind of swing into action to find out where he is, what's going on, and so forth. When we say all of the funds, I think it's important. It's kind of amazing to think of the scale of state government. All of the money, missing money is $367,000 that's gone, which today would be $14 million. That's a lot of money. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the entirety of state government today. The entirety of state government, current fiscal year's budget is $2.4 billion. So you just think the scale of corruption that would have to exist for a person to lose in his own investments and so forth around the state through various ways of placing the state's funds in different accounts around the country or around the state, and then lose a good portion of that money and then leave the country to the tune of $2.4 billion would be, certainly debilitating. So in the midst of this economic crisis that everyone is suffering through, now they have no cash, and they were at the borrowing limit that they were allowed to borrow from.
You want to talk about a rock and a hard place?
Yeah.
Can't imagine. But some I think, smart, quick thinking really gets them going.
Right.
Two of Deadwood's banks advanced $75,000 in loans. Two of the railroads in South Dakota paid their property taxes in January instead of in March.
Right. That was a good move and one that helps keep the state solvent, is get the property tax early from these large payers.
The state auditors going around to each of the county treasurers to have them pay the sum in their possessions that they owed the state. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're looking for every penny they can at the moment.
Right. Because they've got obligations and contracts and bills to pay and salaries to pay and a legislative session to fund. And I mean, not the it costs something to have the legislatures, the members come to Pierre and to conduct this, the business of the legislature and so forth. And they've got zero. So, yeah, they're trying to find every mattress and get to the, every penny in every mattress so they can fund state government.
The legislature also helps pass a law allowing the treasurer to sell bonds for $98,000 to cover the losses for the permanent public school fund. And then there's some extensions that were allowed. So eventually they kind of pull back from the brink, but it's not without almost Herculean effort.
Right. You think you can get through a lot of these ways. You can maybe fund a quarter of state government's fiscal year or a few months to keep going. But yeah, and what's the attorney general? Now he's got to send police, investigators, authorities, and so forth into Mexico and other places to try and find this guy.
Yeah, they, so the attorney general, Co Crawford, at the time, he asks for the legislature to offer a reward of $2,000 for the apprehension of Taylor. The state that's broke is trying to find the guy to get their money back so they can pay them. It's kind of incredible. But the legislature does, and then they increased it in March to $5,000.
Yeah.
So they're circulating W.W. Taylor's likeness, you know, description to all these major cities.
Guadalajara. In the hopes
that someone will, that someone will turn him in. They even get the Pinkertons involved to try and track him down. The
venerable Pinkertons, Security and Investigative Service. They've been around by a couple decades by this time. So,
but it's not until June that anything turns up, and it's a notice from Taylor that says that he's going to be voluntarily reappearing in Pierre at the end of the week.
He's got some friends in Chicago, right? So kind of disentangling this network of his co-investors or bondsmen for the state treasurer, former state treasurer, it becomes a kind of a parade of somewhat notables who are helping him out, not only as attorneys, but there's a bondsman on one of these financial documents that's well known to most South Dakotans. He was governor for two terms, and that's Arthur Millette.
Mm-hmm.
He's no longer governor, but he knows Taylor fairly well. And in fact, in the investigation documents that occur after all of this is being put together for trial and so forth, they talk to Millette quite a bit and they ask him a series of questions, as you might imagine. And Millette is working very hard to not only answer all their questions, but also to cover the bond that he owed. He signed his name to $50,000. Of the state's funds to cover that should it go missing. So now he's basically a debtor for 50 grand, and he begins to sell his personal property, his land that he owns around the state and other places, in order to cover that debt. Other bondsmen do other things.
A lot of them aren't in the state
right
off the bat. And so Crawford has to bring it up in other states' courts, saying, you know, we're owed however much money from X, Y, or Z individual. And a lot of them get rejected because Crawford is claiming the $300,000+. But in South Dakota's law, it said that they were only on the hook for $250,000. And a lot of the other states' courts said, well, the land that's been sold in the state under Taylor's lands are worth that much. So you're not, you know, we're not going to let our citizen of New York, for example.
I mean, it seems to me, I don't know that I understand all the financing, particularly the 1890s, but the economic depression that's occurring around the country is driving land values down. And so land that might be worth, you know, $300,000 one day because of the depression and the devaluation of all this is not. And so they have to kind of go with live numbers, not the numbers of several months ago.
Right. And I think it's even talked about that some of the mines that Taylor had invested in
Cripple Creek in Colorado.
Yeah. Right. They were offered to, I think, sell the shares for like 10 cents. And just a few years later in 1889, I think they were worthless.
Yeah.
And so you get to this point where all of his, I mean, it's bad investments, it's economic depression, it's all of these factors are leading to Taylor making worse and worse decisions.
Right. Well, and having, and the state having fewer and fewer options about how they're going to get that back. So, that he comes up on the radar in Chicago, and I think he's got family members in New York too, communicating to the Attorney General in South Dakota that he's willing to stand trial. But in some of the documents about the work and effort here to do, well, the legislature in the investigation then finds out later that he wanted to kind of fence off $100,000. And if he was allowed to maintain that or not be accountable for $100,000 of the total debt, he would come in. Well, this is, it just gives him another charge to charge him with, you know, another crime to charge him with when he tries to pull something like that. So it's amazing that somebody can go from, and being driven by the economic calamity at the time, somebody can go from probably conducting his affairs pretty well, seen as being pretty successful, being reelected to this office, the treasurer of the state of South Dakota, and then conducting business all across the state in banks from not only Redfield, but Pierre, Watertown, Dolan, Vermilion, DeSmet, Brookings, Elk Point, Salem. I mean, it's a kind of a long list of where he's got the state's funds. And his own funds are around in other banks. And all of that would bring a lot of opportunity to earn a reputation that's good. And he had until his term was up and he had to show up and account for the funds to turn over to his successor. And then he's not. His name is Mudd.
And Taylor is, you know, as he's absconding, he really doesn't have that much to his name anymore. His attorney in Aberdeen, Charles T. McCoy, as well as his attorney, he has a lawyer in Chicago, Daniel Tenney, they let the investigators know that he had recently lost $232,000, part of that, $110,000 of which were his the failings of the Northwestern Mortgage Trust of Redfield and the Gettysburg Bank, $52,000 in a Mexican silver mine. Another $2,700 in a South American mining adventure.
Was he investing the state's money in this, or this is his funds, or is it not clear?
It's never quite clear, because what he was doing was taking the interest off of the state funds and using that for the investments, and his own personal funds were getting commingled with state, and there was no way to figure out what was what, whose he was spending, because it just wasn't tracked in a way that was
sensical.
Makes sense to you or I, right?
Yeah. Or even an accountant at the time, imagine. Well, so he's sitting in Chicago and he agrees to stand trial. He pleads guilty. And what's the charge? And in all of the legalese, what's the actual charges going to look like?
Taylor pleads guilty to an indictment charging him with the crime of embezzlement. And that's on the 13th of August of 1895. So he gets charged with that. The next morning, he's sentenced to a term of 5 years of hard labor at the state pen. And so then that following day on the 15th, Taylor obtains a writ of habeas corpus from the state Supreme Court on the ground that files a writ of habeas corpus from the state Supreme Court on the ground that the punishment was excessive and that by law it could not exceed 2 years.
And why is that?
So this is another example of kind of the early laws not quite
matching the need.
Right. They don't quite fit the bill. So the court ruled that section 1665 of the compiled laws of 1887, which allowed for a sentence of up to 21 years, was defective in wording, being, quote, in form but a skeleton, in substance inanimate, and that it provided nothing for the act named embezzlement to operate upon.
So, in effect, there are no laws against a public official embezzling public funds.
Right. The law that was supposed to cover embezzlement of public funds never mentioned the taking of government monies at all. It's all bark and no bite. So,
well, one of the first acts that the first legislative session will do, and this is just as South Dakota is becoming a state, is they have a kind of a special session in December of 1889, November, December of 1889. And in that time frame, they elect South Dakota's first senators. And then they also effectively pass a bill saying all standing territorial laws are now in effect in the state of South Dakota. So we're just going to roll over all the territorial laws. And then, of course, when they come back into session in January of 1890, there's a ton of other bills, and there's a full-up session, and they conduct regular business. But throughout the 1890s, then, in their work, they are, for the most part, trying to solve problems that are confronting them in the, you know, at the present time. There's very little opportunity to kind of go back and see, I wonder where the gaps are in our embezzlement laws or our fiscal matters and the public trust and this kind of thing. Furthermore, the legislature doesn't meet every year. They just meet every other year. That occurs until the 1960s. So their opportunity to kind of cover these gaps are few by 1895. In fact, they only had, they were about to start their third full session. So I can say, nobody thought about this. Well, they were probably resting on the fact that the territorial statutes, which now were the state statutes, were sufficient. And even the court was finding out the hard way that they weren't.
Right. And there were other laws that allowed a sentence of up to 5 years, but the Supreme Court ruled that they couldn't be used because the state treasurer, the state is a body politic and not an association, society, corporation, public or private. And so the only statute that they could find on the rules that pertain to this case had a maximum sentence, a maximum penalty of 2 years, of which, you know, Taylor only serves, he gets 4 months off for good behavior. And so he serves a total of 18 months in the state pen.
18 months. Now, when you think about that, they find out on the 8th, 9th, 10th of January, the public finds out that the state treasurer has lost all these funds and has left the country. He reappears in August of that year. So there's several months here where he's kind of wandering around Latin America, going from Mexico to El Salvador to Costa Rica to a whole list of places. And while he's thinking he's going to have to come in at some point because he doesn't, I mean, his money is gone. It's not like he had a stash of $367,000 in his wagon and buggy when he leaves. He doesn't have much either, so his walking around money is gone. And when he appears back in Chicago, extradition and so forth, this all takes some time. The trial takes some time to go through this, and now he's served 4 months of time. What's the general view of the public? What's being said in the papers about all of this, even before we get to trial?
There's already this feeling that there's a backroom deal going on. And that they're trying to get Taylor off easy. So this is the different newspapers throughout the state, but the Argus Leader has a very loud voice during this. Once it's found out, the court's decision on October 12th, the paper wrote and called it the blackest day which South Dakota has known since her entrance into the Union. The whole world has watched this matter. It is noted that the men who stole a few dollars worth of bread or money have been sent to the penitentiary for years, but that the rich, influential, popular, and politically powerful thief who steals a quarter of a million gets a punishment of only a year and a half.
Yeah, that's after the debacle of the trial and the missentencing and the writ to the Supreme Court and so forth. So,
right. Yeah. He continues on saying that a crime has been committed against the good name and the credit of every resident of the state. It is a crime for which they will suffer for years. Mm-hmm. The editor continues suggesting that for Taylor to have escaped entirely, it would have been better for him to escape entirely from the state than to have, quote, allowed him to escape like this. There has been a most regrettable miscarriage of justice.
Right. Yeah, the suspicion is thick. And the Populist Party has combined with wings of the Democratic Party and a few of the Republicans to kind of beat up the current governor and attorney general, Republican governor and attorney general in South Dakota, Governor Sheldon, and head into the elections of 1896. And that's how Governor Lee gets elected. It's one of the reasons why he squeaks by with, I think, 400 votes to spare or something. As we talked about in the last podcast, he's elected largely on the economic calamity that's occurring in the state and in the country, but also by the seeming malfeasance of not only the state treasurer, but the collusion of a lot of these, a lot of his buddies in state government, and the Republican Party really takes the brunt of those accusations. It's important to note, though, that he winds up serving out his sentence, as brief as it is, in the state penitentiary, which is where the penitentiary is today, the same building. So W.W. Taylor's up there. His wife takes up a residence in a house near the penitentiary and visits him dutifully as often as she can, seeing to his affairs and trying to make amends with his friends and now his new enemies and so forth. And then when he gets out, they don't stay married.
No,
they don't stay married. This poor woman. It's kind of amazing. He heads off. He gets out of state because he probably realizes pretty quickly he doesn't have much of a future in banking or much of anything in South Dakota. Leaves, goes to Chicago, and their marriage is announced in the paper that they're divorced. And it seems to be that there's another woman.
Yeah, there's another. And this is kind of curious. The sources point out that this is when a lot of his bondsmen really kind of turn on him.
Right. Yeah.
This is a bridge too far.
As if the previous stuff wasn't enough.
Right.
Wasn't enough.
I think there was a perception that he had been just this aggrieved, you know, who no one could have foreseen the economic consequences of 1893. He made some bad decisions. The running's not great, but shouldn't have done that. But
yeah, leaving the country is not a good look. Yeah,
right. This is where we're at. But once he runs off with his mistress and now a new wife, there's definitely a perception shift for his bondsmen, and a lot of them sort of cut ties there.
It's not boding well. He tries to kind of pick up his life again in banking and finance and is struggling, begins to drink and overdrink, and his second wife leaves him, and he gains a lot of weight. The pictures, we have his mugshot, you know, the photograph of him and the official photo of state treasurer and so forth. I'm sure toward the end of his life, he's not looking as handsome and as well-dressed as he was in this photo in the early 1890s. Now, we mentioned the bondsmen. These guys are key in all of this because if the state is going to recapture its fiscal soundness, it's going to have to figure out a way to extract some value from these properties that the bondsmen are selling off or that the state is taking in order to recover its funds from Taylor and use that as collateral to borrow money. And so how is all that working out?
Yeah, so Governor Lee ends up persuading the legislature to pass a law permitting the state to sell and lease the Taylor lands. And so there's a small committee that's put together, and the Taylor lands are part of the financial report for the state up until the 80s.
Yeah, 1983.
So the Taylor lands are just, I think they're only averaging maybe $1,700 a year or something to that effect. But they were helping to recoup the cost. Mm-hmm. And some of these bondsmen, most of them actually, as we talked about a little earlier, are fighting to retain their assets,
right?
Except for former Governor Millett.
Yes, Arthur Millett.
He's fully cooperative, and this will end up with him dying penniless, really.
Right. His very nice home in Watertown. He'd been a lawyer and a businessman in Watertown prior to entering politics, was heavily involved in territorial politics. In fact, he was the final territorial governor and then becomes the first governor of South Dakota and left that office in 1893, would have been. Yeah. But he still, of course, his businesses can continue. But then when this happens, he's got to raise these funds and he sells off the land. He winds up selling his home in Watertown and ultimately moving to Kansas, where he dies broke. And that's where he's buried today, is in Kansas.
Yeah, passes away in 1896, just a few years, just a year after this.
It's really a sad story for so many reasons, but his personal involvement in all of this is, he does the honorable thing, but it comes with a cost.
And eventually his wife, Margaret Millett, is able to petition to get finally to the Supreme Court of South Dakota. And get the building back, the house back. They found that Millett's obligations under his $50,000 bond for Taylor had been more than satisfied.
Yeah, it's like he's trying to pay off beyond the $50,000 that he himself was responsible for, because the others didn't, and so he's trying to be the bondsman for the entirety of the whole bill.
Yeah, eventually the building gets abandoned. And
and when you say building, you mean this home in Watertown?
The mansion, right? The family lives in there until the 30s or 40s, on and off. The city's going to condemn it, and then the Millett Memorial Association is organized and has helped to keep it open since 1946, so you can still go and see that in Watertown.
Right, and I've been there in Watertown a couple of years ago, visited. And it's really quite a majestic house. They have it arranged with some of the original furniture. Not a lot, but much of it, the period furniture. And by original, I mean belonging to the Millett family. But there are several things in there. And just the home, the spiral staircase kind of in the back, that was neat to see. The musical instruments, the books, just kind of how he lived. How he and his family lived is certainly interesting. And the location right there, kind of on the hillside, you can imagine it with, at a time when there were fewer trees. So he would have had a view of the landscape to the, I guess it would be the west. You're from Watertown, am I
up on St. Anne's Hill.
Mm-hmm. St. Anne's Hill, that's right. So it's we're very fortunate that they, in the 1940s, took it upon themselves to organize this way and purchase the house, and that they keep it going to this day. It's a great place to go visit, take school trips, and understand how people lived in the 1880s and 1890s, mm-hmm. and in the 1920s.
So Governor Lee, you know, he doesn't stop there, though, with just the Taylor lands and the funds. The legislature is busy in 1903 passing a law that raises the bond for the state treasurer and his deputies from $250,000 to $500,000 throughout the 1900s, the early 1900s. They're passing laws about state finances that will help to restrict the freedom that the treasurer has.
And the accountability that they'll have with various audits, demonstration of where the funds are. In fact, doesn't the legislature pass a law that every year they want to see the money? So they need to bring it back to town, to bring all of the cash back to pier so the legislature can inspect it.
Governor Lee persuades the legislature and they decide to show all the state funds. So in January of 1897, they bring it all, nearly $300,000, to pier. They have, you know, armed bank messengers, National Guardsmen walking with this money.
Right. Which is in horse-drawn wagons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just incredible. And there's some pictures that you can find of these. They bring them in. They count them all. All right. Yeah. And then they turn around and go to return
Take
the funds.
Yeah.
Right. But the train that's carrying the money gets stuck in the snow near Highmore.
Uh-oh.
And so they decide from that point on, well, we don't need to see the actual counting of each cent. But
yeah,
they did have a very public counting of the funds just as a way to assure the public and the legislators that, yeah, we really have all that we say we have.
Yeah, and the repercussions are decades long. As we said, it goes into 1983 until this is kind of financially settled. What in the end happens to Taylor?
Taylor serves his time. He gets out. Mm-hmm. We talked about he goes to Chicago. He's kind of has a few other odd jobs. But finally, he ends up passing away in New York from alcoholism in December of 1916.
But before dying, he remarried his first wife. I mean,
right?
It's he's quite a guy. He's quite a guy. A whole just sad kind of story.
Yep, and you can find he's buried in Springvale Cemetery in Lafayette, Indiana.
Well, next time I'm in Lafayette, Indiana, I'll have to
when you're passing on through.
By. Yeah, you can see though that in an era of tremendous populist political fervor and incredible malfeasance with light legal and fiscal practices just would embed in the people of South Dakota a tremendous suspicion against its government. And so, yeah, out go the Republicans in the next election. It's close. I mean, it's not an overwhelming landslide for this new fusionist party. And there's other issues that are involved, but embedded very, very quickly in South Dakota's history is this suspicion of inside government dealing and taking care of one another, and those that are come up on the radar as malfeasant are just going to get a good deal, but the guy who, as the newspaper said, steals a loaf of bread or something like this, he's going to pay a steeper price. And that's been, I don't know if you call it a streak, but a belief. And a lot of South Dakotans from the very, almost the very beginning of statehood is that there's malfeasance afoot everywhere you look.
Although I do think it's interesting to note that there's only really one other example of the state treasurer during this time kind of getting caught doing a similar act. It happens in 1925.
Depression. Right. And that, I think, is a lot of the background story with Gladys Piles running for governor. And one of her opposition candidates within the Republican Party was that kind of scene of the insurance commissioner and the banking commissioner and the malfeasance that was occurring then in the mid-20s. So, yeah. But you're right. The Office of Treasurer and other political players might have a bad rap, but in the big scheme of things, a couple of scoundrels, one in the 1890s and one in the 1920s, probably shouldn't be tarring and feathering all of state government.
But, you know, a drop of dye can just change the entire color of an office.
Yeah.
I mean, it really can.
Yeah. Well, where can folks go to find out if they want to know the details about this fella?
There's a great journal article. It's called A State Treasurer Defaults, the Taylor Case of 1895. It was published by the South Dakota State Historical Society. So that's a great resource. Also talked about in the Alex C. Johnson memoir, also published by the State Historical Society. So those are two wonderful sources that you can go to learn a little bit about W.W. Taylor.
The author of that first article is C. Perry Armitage.
Right.
Give him his due. And then if you want to dig into the state library digitized files, you could find the 1905 report that goes into all of the minutia, details, testimony, and so forth. You can read Governor Millett's testimony and all the others. Some couple hundred pages worth of materials here. 480 pages of all of the details between the Attorney General and the investigation and how they found out how the money disappeared.
And then, well, the Supreme Court opinions that Taylor was a part of are also available. Those are cases 746 and 749.
In the Supreme Court records, right.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Okay, Braden. We've wandered through, one of the nicknames for him is Wandering Willie. So we've wandered through Wandering Willie's record here, who's really named Walter. And in fact, his travels through Latin America took notice of the newspaper, and they had a lot of fun with it. At one point, a local newspaper alliteratively headlined the news thus, "Whoop! Wandering Willie works westward with waddling walk, weary, wrecked. We will wonder while waiting where Wandering Willie went." Ultimately, he does a brief stay in the state pen, as we've described. So, fun for all with this story.
No headlines like that anymore.
Not, thankfully. Thanks, Brady.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, or the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.